Welcome to Legal Talk, a monthly conversation about the American legal system with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore.
Good morning, Justice Moore. How you doing?
Morning, Rich.
Good to see you, sir.
Great to see you. Great to be here.
Yeah, we had a chance to chat on Saturday night at the Northfield Chairs and Evening of Entertainment celebration,
yes.
Whatever we want to call it.
Yeah, very enjoyable.
And I was really, really happy to see you because we hadn't touched base about this show yet. So
right.
It was good to have a
prep session.
Yeah, no kidding. So since you and I last spoke, I want to talk about the calendar, and there's a couple other things I want to talk about. But since you and I last spoke, there's been a fairly important announcement or two having to do with the Minnesota State Supreme Court.
Yes, there has, Rich. As we discussed in August when I was last here, we knew the governor was going to make some announcements, yep, regarding the composition of the court, and that did happen. On August 23rd, Governor Walz announced the appointment of Natalie Hudson to be the new Chief Justice, replacing Lori Gilday, effective October 2nd, mm-hmm, on Chief Justice Gilday's retirement from the court on the previous day, October 1st. As many listeners would recognize, Justice Hudson is an associate justice on the court. She was appointed to that position back in October of 2015 by Governor Dayton. And before that, she had been a judge on the Court of Appeals for, mm-hmm, 13 years. She practiced criminal appellate law with the Attorney General's Office for 8 years and also served for a brief time as a St. Paul City Attorney. She started her career representing indigent clients as a staff attorney with the Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services Office. So, yes, Chief Justice Hudson as of October 2nd. So that'll, okay, be a big change for our court. Chief Justice Gilday has been there since 2010. So it's a long time.
She's the third longest serving Chief Justice in state history and the longest basically since the 19th century, right?
I believe that's correct. I think in the last 100 years, I think she does have that record. She's been incredibly impactful, I guess, if you could use that word, with regard to the branches dealing with the COVID, mm-hmm, pandemic, and, mm-hmm, how the court had to shift to virtual forms, yep, of court through, yep, Zoom. And the other thing that she gets a lot of credit for is the creation of the Minnesota Court Records Online program. So now you don't have to go to the courthouse to look at court filings that are public. You can actually go to the website, and if they are regarding recent cases, right, you can download them from your computer, which is a kind of an access to justice and transparency issue.
Sure.
She also spearheaded the transition in the court system from paper to computers,
right,
with regard to how records are kept. And, you know, I experienced that, Rich, just in my district court tenure, the old days of the,
sure,
stacks of files being brought to,
yeah,
your office. And then one day they just said, no longer, it's all on the computer.
I'm sorry. Tell me again, when did she take office? Was it 20?
I believe it was 2010.
Okay.
I think she'd been an associate justice since 2006.
So she's the one that put everything online, put everything, digitized everything. In 2010, she dragged the system then into the 21st century. I mean,
yeah,
that was overdue.
It was. And in fairness, she would be the first to say that she didn't do that on her own. The, mm-hmm, Judicial Council, the governing body for the court system, is the policy making body for the entire judicial branch. But somebody's got to be the sort of the captain of that ship.
Well, it was on her watch. Or,
yeah, it sure, yeah, was. And she, I can tell you, Rich, there were a lot of my colleagues in the district court that had to be kind of dragged kicking and screaming into the 21st century.
I don't doubt that.
I literally followed a judge on the district court that was proud of the fact he had never turned his computer on the bench. And there's another judge who will go unnamed in another county, which will also go unnamed, that used to purposely take the computer monitor off the bench and stick it under the bench itself. And then the IT people come put it back up because he felt it was unbecoming for a judge to look like an air traffic controller.
Oh, that's,
you know, staring at a bunch of screens.
That's
and
super
funny. I will confess to being somewhat in the middle on this.
Okay.
I don't think people want to watch judges looking at screens in in courtrooms. And so I had one screen. I had it tilted down as far as possible, and I really tried to avoid giving people the impression that I was just, you know, checking email during court appearances. I mean, that's just, or jurors too. I used to tell jurors, look, I'm not looking at email or Facebook unless it, unless the email pertains to something that I need to know about, you know, kind of a crisis thing. So yeah, Chief Justice Gilday has had just an incredible impact on the courts, and she'll be missed.
I have to ask, as a justice on the Supreme Court, do you guys have screens in front of you when you're sitting on the bench?
We do take laptops up, laptops or other like iPad devices.
I don't have any problem with that.
Yeah, I think it's, they're unobtrusive. I mean, they don't block any, and frankly, you know, Chief Justice Gilday is, you know, careful about the public dollar and the amount of money being spent on printing briefs. I mean, you, these files are enormous.
You know, this might be a conversation for another show, but are you using your computer as you're listening to arguments? And you know, we expect that you're going to be asking questions of the people before you. Are you using your technology to sort of research the question you might want to ask before you, or are you coming to the bench with some pretty good knowledge already?
Ideally, it's the latter. But during, sometimes during oral arguments, a point comes up that you want to check into. And so we have an intro messaging app that we use with our clerks. And sometimes we'll send a quick message, hey, check out that claim, or, you know, where's this document that's being referred to? I, you know, what I usually do is have the briefs and our bench memo pulled up on the computer, ready to go. But realistically, you can't be listening and reading briefs in the same time. I mean, that doesn't work. The ideal preparation is to have a set of general areas of inquiry and maybe some specific questions as you go into it. And then that gets refined by, frankly, sometimes some of your colleagues ask all the good questions, and then you're sitting there thinking, okay, well, do I speak just to say something, or do I just, you know, keep my mouth shut?
Did you ever see the movie First Monday in October?
I don't think so.
Walter Matthau plays a member of the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's about a woman coming out. This is like 1980, I think they made this movie. And so a woman coming out of the Supreme Court for the first time. And there's a very comical scene about justices passing notes back and forth during arguments. Anyway, okay.
That does happen on occasion. Yeah. That does happen sometimes. I mean, sometimes somebody will forget to turn on or off a microphone, or, you know, that's really important for the live stream, because the live stream is triggered by who's speaking. And so if you've got multiple people with microphones on, that doesn't work so well.
Right.
But yeah, we do try to listen and try to focus and try to not be distracted by technology. Yeah. Technology is a huge distraction. I purposely turn my cell phone off before I go on the bench. I don't want to know, you know, what notifications I'm getting pushed to me from the Star Tribune or something. I mean, we need to focus on what we're there to do. And so, but that's the...
You're not checking the twin score while you're listening to arguments.
No, I'm not. God bless you. That's the challenges of technology, though, because technology gives us access to, you know, information that we could never have imagined, but it's also an incredible distraction from people that are presently in the room. And so, you know, if we're going to bother to have oral arguments, it's incumbent on us to listen to what people are saying.
Yeah. Okay. So then back to the new Chief Justice, Justice Hudson, or the Chief Justice Delegate until October 2nd.
Right.
You have served with her for 3 years.
Yeah, a little over 3 years. I'm starting my fourth year with her. She was the liaison to my former judicial district. Every judicial district has a Supreme Court justice that would come out. And so I got to know her a little bit through that. And I've always been impressed by her just warmth and kindness and sincerity. She comes from a really remarkable family. Her father was African-American football coach at McAllister College in the late 60s, early 70s, at a time when, you know, that wasn't happening.
No.
I mean, head football coaches at colleges were typically not African-Americans.
And at McAllister, too. I mean, great, great respected school, but a little bit on the conservative side, so yeah.
Well, it's...
At least in 1970 it was.
You know, McAllister broke that barrier by hiring Mr. Hudson to be their coach. And so Natalie grew up in Missouri, actually, I believe, but came to Minnesota and then went to law school at the University of Minnesota. And she's been somebody that's just been around important issues throughout her entire career. She was part of the racial bias task force at the Supreme Court, employed to really take a hard look at where our system was failing on the issue of race bias. But she's not a strident type of person that's going to, you know, pound you over your head with her views on things. She's quietly importantly just very persuasive, and she's very reliant on precedent and our case law and our history. She's very aware of that. She's not somebody that's, you know, going to be starting a revolution tomorrow with some ideas that are just out of bounds. I mean, she's very much aware of precedent, but she's also got a justice bone in her, which is really important for the position. I mean, you know, and we all have that, but, you know, sometimes you need to have, you know, sort of a moral voice on the court to remind us of those things. And I would say Justice Hudson serves in that role sometimes to kind of tweak us a little bit.
Interesting.
And, you know, when, I mean, the perspective of, you know, white people on the court may differ from others. And in that, you know,
no question.
I mean, obviously the life experience factor is a big difference.
It has to figure
so, out. So, you know, the diversity of voices on the court makes the court stronger. She's been an important part of that. And, you know, so she'll be excellent. We're very happy for Justice Hudson. I mean, she's, you know, she's approaching the end of her career. I mean, she's going to be 67, I think, coming up this year. And so, you know, she isn't going to be one of these chief justices who can serve for a long, long time.
Right.
But I think she can make an important contribution during the time that she has.
You as a Supreme Court justice, you age out at 70, correct? I mean, that's when we ask you to step down.
All of the judges in Minnesota, yes, 70 is the mandatory retirement. You can serve until the last day of the month in which you turn 70.
Got it.
And so, yeah, we'll have to see what she decides to do. She'll have to be on the ballot next fall.
She will.
Yes, because of the way that this works. And so, but, you know, she was elected with a strong majority the last time she was on the ballot. And, so we're not too worried about that. But she's, she takes over on October 2nd, and she will find out quickly about the rest of the job that we, you know, the associate justices don't know about, that the chief has to deal with, you know, the behind the scenes personnel issues and some of the tough fiscal decisions. And, you know, times have been good. And so it's been, you know, the legislature was, you know, very, very helpful this year, very generous to the court system. But there have been some other years where things haven't been so great. And so, you know, the leadership through the tough times is important as well. And that, you know, Chief Justice Gilday obviously had that plus the COVID pandemic to deal with.
Which, my gosh, I just want to say, it's my opinion that Justice Gilday navigated the COVID situation as well as anyone possibly could have.
Yeah, the trains continued to run on time.
They did.
I mean, it was different.
Every court wound up with a pretty big backlog, but that's going
to
happen.
It did because of the inability to have certain types of in-person hearings. Right. But the good news, Rich, is that backlog, the Judicial Council set targets to have that eliminated, and by next July, the belief is that we're going to achieve those targets. Many judicial districts have already done so. Yep. Some of our bigger judicial districts are still struggling with, you know, the double whammy of deferred cases and an increase in new filings because of, you know, post-pandemic things. And so, you know, we can't control filing numbers, but how we handle them, we can control. And you know, frankly, this continued to show us what technology can do for the court system. And there will be some vestiges of Zoom hearings and virtual hearings that will continue and have continued because the public has told us that they like it and lawyers like it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, for the right kind of cases, you save time and money. And so if you are an employee on break from work, you could make a quick appearance at your, you know, family law case, and you don't have to take off time and drive in. And so there are good things behind virtual hearings. However, I must say that You know, for there are hearings that there's no substitute for having people in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And there are differences of opinion on this topic. And this is a work in progress because, right. you know, some judges feel very strongly that Zoom hearings have contributed to a lot of judicial fatigue and frankly, a lack of decorum, which I think has been a concern in some cases. You know, are you really on court if you're sitting, you know, on your couch at home, you know? And it doesn't take too long to look through a Google search and see, you know, kind of bad court hearing, you know, exhibit A type of cases that people post. But I think for the most part, the Zoom hearings were necessary to get us through the pandemic, and they're going to continue in one form or another moving forward.
The thing I don't like about Zoom is I can't stand up and pace while I'm at
it. Well, people do stand up and pace, and it's amazing what they show you sometimes, Rich. And then what other kind of comical things came out of the Zoom court hearings are, frankly, lawyers of my vintage and mm-hmm. others that have technology challenges,
sure.
like you know, the guy that couldn't turn the cat filter off, he had to convince the judge he wasn't a cat. That meme has gone around the internet. And you know, we've all had those moments of kind of Zoom fatigue or Zoom, you know, technology glitches where you didn't think that you were recording and you were recording. I think judges don't want to be IT people.
We don't want you to be IT people either. You have more important things to do.
So yeah, we have court reporters and our court staff that have had to learn how to operate this and do so on short notice and have done just an incredible job. The people that keep our court system going are the court reporters, the court staff, the law clerks. And we owe them a debt of gratitude. So, yeah, we're going to move forward on October 2nd, Rich. And I think it'll be a status quo type of a change, frankly.
Okay. You don't foresee a lot of difference in leadership style?
You know, there'll be a difference in style, no question about that. They're obviously different mm-hmm. people, different mm-hmm. personalities. But substantively, I think you're going to see a continuation of what's worked. I would hope that to the extent there are things that we need to work on, that mm-hmm. we can continue to have those discussions and maybe get a few different perspectives to the table. But I don't envision a wholesale, you know, upheaval of anything. Sure. I think it's going to be a kind of a maintenance status quo, maybe a bridge to the next Chief Justice, you know, down the road, probably.
Okay. So with Justice Hudson's ascension to the top chair, you have another associate justice coming on board as well.
We do. Carl Procaccini will be the new associate justice that will take the place of I guess it's Hudson's moves to the chief's position. So yep. Procaccini will take her spot effective October 2nd as well. So we'll have he will be joining our court. Carl Procaccini comes to us from the University of St. Thomas School of Law, where he's currently a professor. He's most well known for previously serving as general counsel to Governor Walz mm-hmm. over the past 4 years. And he really was the person that led the governor's legal and appointments team and obviously was heavily involved with the pandemic. I mean, that kind of defined his time there in terms of the executive orders and things like that.
Right.
But he was involved in managing litigation and the various complicated legal issues the state's dealing with all across state government. And before that, he was a partner at the Green Espel law firm in Minneapolis.
Okay.
Very well, highly regarded a law firm where his practice there was a litigation and investigations practice. Incoming Justice Procaccini's also taught at William Mitchell. He's published on topics relating to executive clemency, attorney-client privilege. His background is highlighted by two federal clerkships. He clerked for Judge Diana Murphy on the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals, who is kind of a legendary federal judge, very, very highly regarded. Justice Chudich of our court also clerked for Judge Murphy. And he also clerked for Chief Judge Michael Davis on the United States District Court for the District of Minnesota, another legend in local legal services. So Justice Procaccini has seen a couple of federal judges who are highly regarded up close and personal. And so he will be joining us as well. And, you know, he has the interesting situation of literally taking the oath of office and walking right onto the bench.
Yeah, he does. He has an extensive legal background, and he's clerked for two judges. Has he ever been a judge?
No, he has not been a judge. And, you know, his relative legal experience in terms of, you know, like how many appellate cases has he had, how many court cases, you know, his work has been behind the scenes a lot. So he doesn't have the, like, for instance, Justice Hudson, when she came to the court, had been, you know, an appellate lawyer that was repeatedly coming before the court. So Justice Procaccini will bring a different background. Mm-hmm. It'll be a little bit more of a law professor, corporate counsel type of background. Mm-hmm. But every voice on the court is important. We don't want seven people that have the same background.
Right.
And, you know, he's highly regarded. I mean, he's frankly got a gold-plated resume from law schools. Yeah. And he's as an individual, he's a really nice person. When I went through my application processes back in 2019 and 2020, when I was a candidate for the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, he was one of the people that was involved in the vetting and the interviewing of me. And so it's a little interesting because you don't know what they know.
Right.
And so, you know, they do a lot of vetting. And so Justice Procaccini may know more about my background than I do, frankly. but he's been very good natured about it. And we're looking forward to having him join the court. We have a tradition where the new justice gets the famous goose statue that has one of Ellen Page's bow ties on it.
And
notes are written to the new incoming justice, so welcoming that person to the court. So I will be able to move the goose into Justice Procaccini's chambers where he can enjoy the letters from colleagues.
It occurs to me that you're not going to be the new kid anymore.
I'm not. I get to. We're not moving offices right away. That's going to wait until Justice Anderson retires, but there's typically a chamber shuffle and then a chair shuffle on the bench because it's all seniority based. And so, I will move from acute court watchers will notice that I'm usually on the right side. As you're looking at the bench, I'll be on the left side effective October 2nd.
That's not going to mess with your perspective on anything.
It's not. Yeah. It's probably a good thing to have a different perspective.
Sure.
They change chairs in conference. So, Justice McKagan, I'll move down, I assume, to that side. And Thiessen and Shudich will move the other way. But in any event, we'll figure it out and it'll be a new court. I mean, it'll be a profoundly new court.
So with the new court, first of all, I guess we should talk about what have you guys been up to the last month? What has happened with the court in the last month?
Well, we hit the ground running after Labor Day, as we always do. That's a bit of a jarring, you know, back to reality moment, just like, you know, our teachers
first day
and
of
students.
School.
It had a little bit of that feel to it. You know, we get 2 months away from our oral arguments, and there's some time for traveling and for other opinion work. But yes, we're back at it in September. I think our cases from September provided some really thorny issues. I mean, they always do, but this group had some challenging ones on it that obviously we're still working through. In the meantime, we're trying to get our work finalized from last term. We've got some opinions that haven't been finalized, and typically they're the tough ones. And now we're preparing for the October calendar. We got 12 cases coming up, including two first-degree murder direct appeals and two attorney discipline cases and eight petitions for review. So our new clerks are well into working on their October cases.
They've been around for 3 weeks and they're probably just buried in research right now.
They are. The reality of balancing what's to come and what's happened and trying to make sure that you're staying on top of things and not letting moss grow on anything for too long is a challenge. So they're wonderful. We have great law clerks. They're doing a fantastic job. But this from now until the first of the year tends to be a relatively intense time with the court.
Yeah, I would think so. Okay, well, you know, good luck with your new colleagues and everything else. And I'm hoping that I think everyone in the state hopes the transition is extremely smooth.
Yes.
In the meantime, the work of the court goes on, and you and I were talking on Saturday night. Twice a year, the court takes oral arguments to a school.
Correct.
And you have something like that coming up.
We do. For the first time since 2019, it'll be 4 years when we were down in Fairmont. I was there as a district court judge. The court is going back to outstate in
Fantastic.
The fall. And we're going to Montevideo High School on October 11th for a road show.
All right.
The case is State versus Anthony Trifoletti, who is charged and found guilty of second-degree murder, second-degree manslaughter. It's a COVID case. First trial ended in a mistrial. Second trial of Mr. Trifoletti, two of the state's witnesses developed COVID, and the judge allowed the prosecutor to present their testimony through transcripts from the earlier trial. And so the question is, does that entitle Mr. Trifoletti to a new trial on the ground that the district court violated his Sixth Amendment right to confront witnesses against him on the grounds that they were unavailable?
Right.
So here we go again, another COVID-related appeal. We're not quite done with these.
Just weeding through the mess still.
Yeah. So I think this is a really good case for the high school kids. I mean, everybody can relate to COVID and what effects it had on people. And so my understanding is that the Montevideo High School oral argument will also include some students from surrounding high schools. I believe Yellow Medicine East and perhaps Dawson Boyd.
That's great.
Two small school districts out there. So, yeah, we're really looking forward to that. There'll be a community dinner the night before, and it's an opportunity for the court to rub elbows with folks. And it's a highlight of the year, Rich. These high school oral arguments are a lot of fun for the court. We get to go into classrooms and, you know, talk to people about the law and talk about, you know, being a lawyer and whatever else is on their minds.
I cannot praise this program strong enough. I mean, this is the equivalent of the House of Representatives taking the floor and bringing it to Northfield High School. The auditorium at Northfield High School. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. And that is an astonishingly cool opportunity for these kids.
It is great. It started in the early to mid 90s under Chief Justice Sandy Keith from Rochester. And since then, I mean, we're on our 70th or 80th of trip to high schools over the years. We do Metro visit in the spring. We do, like we did Richfield last May, and we do outstate in the fall. And we try to spread around the judicial district. So this is the 8th judicial district, Western Minnesota, and it's wonderful because I'll see a lot of my district court friends from the 8th district that are out there. The judge in Montevideo, Chippewa County, Judge Van Hahn is somebody who I know well, who came onto the bench a few years after I did. So it'll be just fun to be out there. And it's kind of like the 5th district. I mean, that part of the 8th district is, you know, very, you know, rural farm country, although Montevideo is obviously Minnesota River Valley. But there's a lot of history in the Granite Falls area. Obviously, we have some tribal nations in that vicinity, the Upper Sioux in particular. And so there'll be an opportunity for a lot of interesting discussions. So, yeah, that's happening. And then one other case on our calendar the listeners might be aware of or interested in, on October 9th, we hear the appeal of Michael Allen Carbo Jr.'s conviction for first-degree murder out of St. Louis County. Carbo was charged for the 1986 murder of a 38-year-old woman of Chisholm. This was a cold case that was charged out due to DNA testing that was done through a private lab. Carbo was 18 at the time of the incident, and so the state convicted him, and that case is being directly appealed to our court. So Mr. Carbo's case got a lot of attention just because of the nature of a 1986 homicide being prosecuted in 2022.
I would have been 17 at that point. I'm kind of stretching to remember the case. I recognize, but I don't remember.
Listeners, Google Mr. Carbo's name, and you'll find out all sorts of things about it. So without commenting on the merits or anything about that case is coming up. So we're looking, we have an interesting calendar, two attorney discipline cases. They present some unique challenges. And so We will be back at it after the first Monday in October. So we got a couple weeks, 2 weeks from today, actually. So we're trying to scramble to clean up September, deal with last term, and get ready for October.
Right. Well, this has been about the quickest half an hour I think we possibly could have spent. I mean, this has been a great conversation. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up before I turn you loose?
Well, there's some other things we could talk about, Rich. I guess it depends a little bit on how much time you've got.
If you got, if you want to talk, I'm all in.
I mean, we talked a little bit on Saturday about whether listeners would be interested in hearing about guilty pleas and that.
Oh, yes, that's right.
You know, we obviously there's been a prominent case,
yes,
where a guilty plea was rejected by a judge,
right?
The Hunter Biden case, to be particular. Now, Mr. Biden has now been indicted as a result of that agreement falling apart. And so I thought we could briefly talk about guilty pleas, because sometimes people talk about, plea agreements and guilty pleas, and there's sort of this negative connotation that, somebody's, cutting a deal and getting some sort of a spectacular break. Well, the reality of guilty pleas is that the system isn't built for every case to go to trial.
Right.
Not every case should go to trial. Many cases can be and ought to be resolved on reasonable grounds without putting jurors and the court system through a trial.
You know, I do think that there's sort of a, for those of us who aren't connected to legal, anything legal at all, there's sort of this assumption that prosecutors are looking to get convictions because it's, points on the board, really. But that's not really what we're talking about here, is it?
It isn't. I mean, the Justice Department and most county attorney's offices have written guidelines that indicate that a prosecutor is a minister of justice, and the goal isn't just to, create a checklist of convictions, mm-hmm, to advertise to the public. I mean, mm-hmm, you're supposed to do justice, and how justice looks in individual cases can vary dramatically. But generally, the judge has a role. I mean, plea agreements are contracts between the defendant and the state.
Yes.
And the judge, you're told when you come onto the bench, that judges should be careful to not involve themselves in getting materially involved in the discussions about the plea agreement to the extent that they're become like a party to them.
Sure.
You are a referee making sure that the plea meets the requirements of the rules and, frankly, that it's supported by justice.
Right. I mean, you're there to ratify those agreements, essentially.
Yes.
Okay.
In most cases. And so, under our rules, under Rule 15, a judge can accept a plea agreement when the interest of justice would be served. And the rule actually has specific considerations that the court's supposed to consider. Did the defendant, by pleading guilty, aid in ensuring the prompt and certain application of correctional measures? Has the defendant acknowledged guilt and shown a willingness to assume responsibility for the criminal conduct? In other words, basically make concessions and have those concessions make, are there options of alternative measures better adapted to achieve certain goals other than putting someone in jail? Has the defendant made the trial unnecessary where good reasons exist for not having a trial, like not putting victims through a difficult trial?
Mm-hmm.
Has the defendant given or offered cooperation, which could result in the successful prosecution of other offenders? That's a material consideration. And has the defendant, by pleading guilty, avoided delay in the disposition of other cases and contributed to the efficient administration of criminal justice? And so what happens is, in most cases, a written agreement is presented to the court, and that under the rules, the judge has to go through waivers, the mm-hmm. defendant's waiver of rights, and then there's supposed to be a factual colloquy about what happened, and that's supposed to be the defendant's words, not the judge's words.
Mm-hmm.
Where we often see plea agreement cases was where a defendant's trying to withdraw a plea after it's been entered, and they're under the rules that can happen if the withdrawal is necessary to correct a manifest injustice, or if it's fair and just to do so. And so a plea agreement to be valid has to be accurate, voluntary, and intelligent. Accurate means the defendant hasn't pled guilty to a more serious offense that they could be convicted if they went to trial.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be established on an appropriate factual basis. Voluntariness, kind of obvious. The court has to plead guilty for the right reasons and not due to improper coercion or pressure. And, you know, the voluntariness of pleas is one thing the district court judge asks a lot about. Have you been threatened? Have you been promised anything else other than what's on the agreement to get you to plead? And then the key element really is the intelligence requirement. The defendant has to understand the charges against him or her, the rights they're waiving, and the consequences of the plea in terms of what's going to happen. And this is where oftentimes issues can arise. I mean, in terms of what the parties understood the consequences were going to be of a particular situation. The court has the ability to reject a plea agreement if it's not in the interest of justice or if they just think it's too lenient. I mean, if the judge, if persons have a criminal record, and, you know, sometimes the court can just say, look, I can't accept that. You know, I can't. But we're told as judges that, we're reminded as judges that we don't know everything. We don't know as much as the lawyers do. There could be good reasons for this plea agreement coming forward that aren't maybe articulated. And so a lot of times you're, as a district court judge, you're trying to figure out, you know, what's going on here, particularly if you see an agreement that doesn't seem like a typical agreement. And sometimes you'll have the lawyers come back into chambers and you'll say, look, tell me what's going on here, because this isn't the standard type of agreement. Is there something I need to know here?
That was my question. Is, I mean, you're expected to scrutinize the, you as a judge, you're expected to scrutinize these.
Absolutely. You're not a human rubber stamp here.
Right.
And that's what happened in the Hunter Biden case. A federal judge did her job and showed that she wasn't a rubber stamp.
Right.
And so this complex plea agreement was presented to her that included a plea of guilty to failing to pay taxes, and then this complicated diversion agreement where the prosecutors were asking Mr. Biden to admit but not plead guilty to illegally possessing a gun, presumably allegedly obtaining this in violation of federal law because of alleged drug use going on. And so that gun charge was going to be kept off the record entirely, provided that conditions were met. But the agreement fell apart for two reasons. The parties, shockingly, and this was just amazing to many commentators, went into court without really an agreement as to what other potential charges this plea agreement was going to protect this person from. In other words, you know, the federal judge asked Hunter Biden if he could, if he was pleading guilty knowing he could still face additional charges related to his alleged conduct. He said no. The prosecutor said yes. And so, you know, that's a problem. So the question is, you know, when you plead, when a person pleads guilty, what immunity are you getting from that? You know, now that's challenging because let's say it's a DWI case and you come into court and plead guilty to a DWI, but you've committed a murder that nobody knows about. And if that's discovered, you know, 2 weeks later after you plead guilty, are you going to be able to credibly claim that you're immune from being prosecuted for committing a murder? I don't think so. But usually the plea agreements will make it really clear. This agreement precludes the government from prosecuting somebody for this kind of conduct over this type of period of time. And so the parties act in the Biden case actually reworked the deal, and they got to an agreement on immunity, but then this diversion agreement was the thing that broke the whole thing down, because plea agreements are required to be approved by a judge, but diversion agreements aren't. Diversion agreements are private agreements between the government and the defendant, and the judge was rightly, I think, uncomfortable about being put in the position to approve or reject a particular diversion agreement, or whether the you know, the agreement had been violated, and so, you know, she claimed she didn't have the power to revive the gun charge if Mr. Biden violated the terms of the plea agreement, and so it fell through, and now there's an indictment and likely a trial. That's obviously a dramatic example of this, but every day in our courtrooms, judges are asking these questions about plea agreements. You know, what immunity is the defendant getting? Sometimes you've got defendants that have multiple files, and so it can be really complicated to determine what exactly the defendant is agreeing, you know, to plead guilty to, and what are they giving up.
Speaking in broad terms, and this is a loaded question, if you don't want to answer this, I understand. It's probably for the best that this plea agreement was shut down by the judge, just based on the fact that Hunter Biden is the son of the president of the United States, and we don't want to give the appearance of special treatment because of does that ever work into the, like, do you, does that ever work into a plea agreement? You know, like, normally we would be willing to plea out this, this, and this, but because you are in the public eye or because there, you have political connections, we cannot offer you the same sort of accommodation that we would offer somebody else.
Well, on a local level or on a district court level, that is a factor that plays into it. You know, I used to worry about that. Is this agreement the same deal that, you know, Joe Anonymous would be getting, who doesn't have wealth, status, power in a really, right, really, really good privately paid attorney?
Yeah.
Would this person be getting that same deal, or are they getting that because their lawyers know the prosecutors, mm-hmm, and know people? I guess my sense, Rich, is that people shouldn't be treated unfairly because of their prominence. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, should you be treated more harshly? Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe you should be held to account if you were in a position of public office, you know, in public trust. But on the other hand, the question of whether the same standards apply to you, that goes both ways, frankly. Right. You shouldn't be treated, in my opinion, more harshly or more leniently.
Right.
And where that sweet spot is a tough thing. And I'm not going to comment on the Biden case, but there are small p political issues in some cases, where you've got people who are well known locally and prominent or elected officials, and should those people be treated the same as somebody who doesn't have that kind of prominence? I think for the most part the answer should be yes, but it's important that the justice system not be viewed as sweeping things under the rug,
right,
to avoid dealing with them if justice requires them to be dealt with.
Right, equal in the eyes of the law. You don't ever want to say that that's a moving target, but it does. I mean, it just, from a common sense point of view, it does. Those kind of cases it just seems to me would make a judge's job, judge's discretion, that much more difficult.
It can be. I mean, most 98% of most pleas go through without a whole lot of trouble, but the ones that don't are the ones that we end up seeing, or if there's a plea withdrawal motion, or, you know, somebody's claiming their rights were being violated by a subsequent prosecution. Those are the tricky ones.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of litigation over withdrawn plea agreements or attempts to withdraw plea agreements. And I just wanted listeners to understand that the plea agreement, the plea disposition of cases is a acceptable, legitimate, and appropriate way for criminal cases to be resolved.
That's my other question, actually, is, like, the majority of cases that get filed, they get pleaded. What's the percentage of cases that actually go to court?
That actually results in a contested trial. I mean, I'm talking really broadly here, Rich, but mm-hmm, I would assume under 5%.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, most cases, candidly, from my experience as district court judge, most cases are relatively cut and dry. There usually isn't a whole lot of question about what happened. The fight is usually about disposition and, mm-hmm, you know, whether there should be an admission of guilt, whether it could be a diversion, stay of adjudication. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that cases can be resolved. That's generally where the fight is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there is a legitimate fight about whether something happened or whether someone's rights are violated, those are the cases that get litigated in pretrial proceedings and then at omnibus hearings and then at trial. But your average person who, you know, acknowledges making a mistake, they don't want to belabor things or drag it out. They want to get it resolved. They want to know what they're doing and what the results will be and the consequences, but they really don't want to go through a bunch of hoops to get to that point. They want a fair, expeditious, and reasonable outcome. And that's what the plea process serves in most cases.
Fair, expeditious, and reasonable. Those three words aren't exactly in the Constitution, but they ought to be.
Well, I mean, it's kind of that sense that, you know, look, why belabor something? I mean, I used to have to talk people out of pleading guilty at their first bail hearing.
Really?
tell you what, 48 hours in a county jail can get people to be thinking about a lot of things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they would appear often without lawyers at that bail hearing, and I would really almost have to stop them from, you know, confessing. I mean, wow. I literally would have to jump in and tell them, no, we're not going to talk about that. You have a right to a lawyer. You need to talk to a lawyer. And, you know, they were ready to go to church, Rich. I mean, they were ready. It was a full confession moment. And, that's a literally and figuratively sobering experience
sure
to be sitting in a county jail awaiting a bail hearing if you've never had that kind of experience before. And so, yeah, people need to know their rights and they need to understand what the process is. But the plea agreement is part of the process.
Right. All right. Well, thanks for bringing that up because it's such an interesting aspect of the law, and it's actually a really common one that we don't hear a lot about. So.
You don't until you see a case. Again, that's why the Biden case prompted me to think about it, not because I'm commenting in any way, shape, or form.
No, of course not.
Of the Biden case, and that's, I will just say that the United States Supreme Court's Second Amendment decisions, particularly the Bruin case, are going to provide some interesting litigation in that case in terms of what history and tradition shows us about the understanding related to who could possess guns, you know, when the Second Amendment was enacted.
There is some fascinating stuff coming up this fall. So, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens.
So
here.
Stay tuned on that as it develops.
All right. Justice Gordon Moore, we just can't thank you enough for giving us this time every month. It's always a fascinating conversation.
It's great, and I want to just throw out a congratulations to my colleague Mark Vandalist, a district court judge in Scott County, who he and Judge Wilton have a similar radio show on K-Check Radio out of New Prague called All Rise, and Judge Vandalist went to his retirement party last weekend.
Fantastic.
And so he is 2 weekends ago, actually. So, yeah, he's going to call it quits after a distinguished career in Scott and LeSueur counties. And so hats off to Judge Vandalist. I think he's still going to do the radio show. I don't think he's abandoning that. But, it's always mixed feelings about seeing colleagues that you appreciate leave the profession.
Yeah.
But he's retiring sometime this fall. So if you see Judge Vandalist, please congratulate him.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that he's going to keep doing his radio show because we need intelligent voices on the radio.
We do.
Days.
The only problem with Judge Vandalist is his obsession with the Green Bay Packers.
We need intelligent voices.
And I think their show might have been this morning, and there could have been some interesting Packers discussion.
That was a rough game for Green Bay yesterday.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. But have a good week, Rich.
You too, Gordon. And folks, thanks. Justice Moore will be back again next month, third Monday in October, and we will talk to you then.
This has been Legal Talk with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. If you have questions for Justice Moore or would like to suggest a topic for future conversations, email us at contact@kymnradio.net.